The FBI has just proposed an advanced wiretapping system that would allow them to monitor one out of every 100 phone lines in some areas of the country. Although warrants would still be required to conduct the taps, the request alone concerns privacy rights advocates. If the system is put in place, it stands to reason that someone will find cause to use it. Increasingly, it's not just celebrities whose rights to privacy are being compromised. For example, the Fourth Amendment doesn't protect you from a strip search. What about your employer's right to know if you smoke when deciding on health benefits? Should student athletes be tested for drugs without reasonable suspicion? These and other issues concerning the struggle with Big Brother are explored in a new book by Ellen Alderman and Carolyn Kennedy. It's called The Right to Privacy and published by Knopf. I'm very pleased to welcome both of its authors back to New York & Company, and I promise I won't invade your privacy too much anyway. People might expect this to be a diatribe against the press, and maybe that would be justified for some obvious reasons. You do get into celebrity issues, but most of this has to do with right to privacy as it concerns non-public figures.
That's actually one of the most important things that came out of our research, is that in the past and in the media, I think people have an idea that what gets the most attention is invasions of privacy that happen to celebrities or public officials. But actually, where the law is developing is in the area of private individuals whose private lives are exposed.
But is your personal experience one of the reasons you even got interested in this subject?
Sure. This is something that I've dealt with and thought about, my whole life. And at times, the feeling of your privacy being invaded can be, a very difficult and unpleasant thing. But I think in one way, the fact that I have dealt with it for a long time makes it somewhat easier. And I think what we found is that it's even more difficult for people who have never been exposed to this kind of scrutiny. And for example, we have a case in our book of a woman who adopted a child, that was just in the news just now. And 17 years later, the birth mother came back to look for her daughter, who wanted nothing to do with her. And the mother went to the local newspaper for help in finding the child. And the child was just traumatized to find her whole life history on the front page of the local paper. Mm-hmm. And this family was really, terribly upset by the whole experience, and it was very difficult for them to deal with. And the court sided with the Free Press and said that this was a newsworthy story. And so it's a tough thing to balance the free press against individual privacy.
And the Free Press is debating it itself. I remember recently speaking with Fox Butterfield, who was on the show to talk about a man who is the most dangerous criminal in New York State's prison system. But I mentioned that he was also the reporter who revealed the name of the rape victim in a celebrated case. And he said he didn't do it. That was something that one of the editors at the Times did instead. And his name was on the article, and he was very upset about it. People in newspapers are constantly debating this thing. In your case, Ellen Alderman, you didn't have a problem. You didn't grow up in the public spotlight. This is very much a legal matter for you?
Well, I think it's, for me, the same as it is for most people. It's a legal matter in terms of knowing your rights, but it's a very personal matter in terms of hearing these people's stories. As Caroline mentioned, this family we talked to in North Carolina that had their private story in the paper. We also talked to a woman in California whose father had a heart attack, and they called 911. The paramedics came rushing in, and with them came a camera crew, a television crew from the local station, because they were riding around with the paramedics for an upcoming special. And the family was so upset they didn't even know the television people were there until a few weeks later. They were horrified to see their father's dying moments on television. Mm-hmm. So those kind of things are not just legal matters, they're very personal matters, and intrusions into our lives have a huge impact.
But most of the issues that involve right to privacy have to do with criminal activities, don't they?
Certainly under the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches, that involves criminals. But even there, the case we opened the book with is women in Chicago who were picked up for minor traffic violations, making an illegal left-hand turn. And they were taken off to jail and subjected to a degrading strip search. And this went on for decades in Chicago. thousands of women were degraded in this way, not criminals, people picked up for minor traffic violations. And
what
that
was the justification given
by
the police?
It's important to note that it wasn't just Chicago. It was Chicago, Idaho, Colorado, all sorts of states said, well, if anyone's in our jail, the security issues are so dire that we need to strip search everyone, no matter the reason for being there. We're not going to sort out who's here for parking tickets and who's here for attempted murder. And the courts, when it was finally brought to the courts, said that's unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment. So it's really not just criminals.
But right now, with a sense that people want the police to crack down on crime, and you get the feeling that we're moving in the other direction. The courts, especially the Supreme Court, have been a lot more lenient about those kinds of searches and seizures than they were in the 60s.
I think that's true. I think that the court is more likely to find that a search is reasonable than in the past, and many but also people are calling for more public safety and law enforcement. And I think the reason that we did want to focus a little bit on the strip search cases at the same time as we want to be safe, it's very important that we not give up too much privacy and that we do maintain our individual rights, because once we give these things up, it's very hard to get them back. And I think that it is possible for law enforcement to do its job and at the same time respecting privacy. We actually went over to the Port Authority and spent some time there with the police who are charged with trying to intercept some of the drug traffic that goes through the terminal. And in New York, they're actually, the rules are stricter as to what the police can and can't do than they are in many states. And they are, you know, somewhat frustrated, but I think that they actually, you know, do believe that it's, you know, there's so much traffic. The problem is that there's so much traffic in drugs that not that the privacy issues are what are stopping them from doing their job.
It was my sense, watching the way the customs officials act, that if you have swarthy skin, if you've come from certain countries, you're more likely to be searched. And if you look like me, you're more likely to be allowed to go through.
Right. Some of these protections, like the Fourth Amendment, have the ancillary effect of protecting against discrimination. And in those kind of searches, like a roadblock or a custom search, they're trying to balance the facts that they know mean someone's more likely to be carrying drugs, what they call a courier profile, and guarding against the kind of abuse and discrimination just because of what somebody looks like.
In fact, there was a long history of cops on certain highways in the South stopping every car that was driven by a black man because they said that blacks fit the drug courier profile.
Right.
And so if you were black, you were automatically stopped and asked to explain why you're on a public highway.
Well, that it goes back to your point, or question rather, about isn't this really something of concern only to criminals? And of course it's not, because that's a perfect example of why we have the Fourth Amendment saying you can't do this.
But the big problem here is that everything is a matter of balance, isn't it?
Right,
exactly.
And people want more crackdown on criminals. They want the drug dealers put in jail. And at the same time, they're outraged if they wind up being put through this process when they haven't done anything wrong.
It's always a balancing of privacy against another interest.
The minute we hire a policeman, in fact, we're already setting up a situation where some privacy is going to be violated.
All right, and in another area I think that's particularly difficult is in the schools, because there school officials have the responsibility of keeping the students safe, but also of teaching them about democracy and what it's like to live in a free society. So, I mean, we've all read the terrible stories about the safety issues in our schools. And, you know, what kind of power does the school official have to drug test the kids, to search their lockers, to do, you know, weapon searching in the schools?
The court says yes.
And then
yes.
If they find anything, can they turn it over to the police? And is that that's another difficult question that we get into in our book.
And then there's the whole matter of women who bear children and AIDS testing and who should be told and who shouldn't be told. These have become very thorny issues where First Amendment rights activists sometimes disagree. They see the public health as being more important than a person's personal rights.
Well, sure, that's another extremely difficult area, because when you're talking about testing, early detection seems to be, you know, to make a huge difference in the treatment of the disease. And so But on the other hand, a lot of the confidentiality provisions were set up to encourage people to come forward. And there's a real fear that if your HIV status is not protected and not confidential, that people won't even seek testing. So that's a balance. But when you get into the area of newborns, I think that there is this increasing pressure to not only to test the children, but to allow the parents to find out about it.
Right now, we have an added situation with the growth of computerization. There's just so much more opportunity for people we don't even know to find out all sorts of things about us. And we keep on hearing horror stories. Most of them don't frighten me all that much. I don't care if somebody knows that I buy this product rather than that product. I guess I don't care. On some level, it does bother me a bit. In the old days, nobody would have known except the cashier that I was buying this one, not that one.
Right, and that's why the privacy issues are so urgent today, because there's just so many more ways to simply invade people's privacy and gather information about them. But it's tricky because, as you said, it's personal. Some people don't care. Other people care about every bit of information about them, and you do have to worry about the cumulative effect of people gathering this information and creating a profile on you. And so what we have found is that technology is moving very fast and the law is very slow, and it is not up at all to the challenge of protecting our privacy in cyberspace.
And how is it going to be resolved? By new laws or by what we see most, and that's a lot of lawsuits?
Well, in fact, it seems to be a combination. The big question here is, should we just create more laws and more regulation, or should we let market pressure do the job in this whole free enterprise system, and then all of us, you and me, start telling the companies that we care about these issues. We don't want you to turn our information over to someone else. I need to know the safeguards. Or do we need to go to Congress to say pass laws? Right now it's a hodgepodge, and nobody has really developed a comprehensive policy.
Congress right now, if anything, is pulling back and in applying any kind of restrictions, at the same time that it seems to be horrified that the government functions as a kind of a big brother.
Right. Well, that's certainly something that that you mentioned earlier on, that the increasing power of the in the electronic age of this technological capacity to monitor communications is something I think that does get people very concerned. But actually, one of the other things that we found is that for the most part, people are almost less concerned about the government invading their privacy as, you know, many other large interests that are not regulated, because at least with the government, you've got the Fourth Amendment to protect you. You know, you've got the Constitution on your side. But when you're talking about big business or the media or these credit bureaus, people don't really know what's going on and they don't really know what they can do about it.
Also, loved ones and the like, because after we come back, we'll talk a bit about what happens when you take a photograph with a loved one, and then you break up, and then one day you open up Penthouse or Playboy and find your picture in it, or a videotape of a sexual act that you've been involved with. You thought it was all for fun, and it turns out that it's now that other people are watching these things. We're talking about the right to privacy with Ellen Alderman and Carolyn Kennedy. Their book is published by Knopf, and we'll be back right after this. We're back with Ellen Alderman and Carolyn Kennedy, who are attorneys who met at Columbia University School of Law. They have collaborated on two books. The last one brought them here, and I'm pleased to say they've come back for their second, which is The Right to Privacy. It's published by Knopf. And we invite your calls at 212-267-WNYC. I'm sure all of you are concerned about the right to privacy, but we also I want to make it clear that our guests have a right to their own privacy, and so the question should be on legal matters, not on personal matters. And that has to be a concern for you, because your life was so out in the open. And I know that when we called George, your brother's magazine, to find out if somebody from that magazine would collaborate, would be part of a panel on new magazines, we got a machine. There was all sorts of complicated things that you had to do to get through to them. You know, any other magazine has a receptionist. And I assume that's because walls have to be put up for certain people to protect certain people.
Well, I'm sure you'll find they're much better organized over there now. They're just getting off
the
ground.
They actually answer the phone now?
They can afford to have somebody answer the phone.
That's right.
So that's all that it was. I assume that it was reasonably an attempt to protect himself, and I understand that you can't be a hermit. And both of you and a lot of other people who are in the public eye refuse to be totally destroyed by this, but we see a wide range of reactions to paparazzi, from punching the paparazzi in the nose to posing for the paparazzi, and you realize that some people are a lot more private than others.
Right. I mean, obviously, this is probably the most personal right that we have, and everybody reacts differently. We have a case in our book of a man whose picture was taken crossing the street here in New York, and it wound up on the front cover of the New York Times Sunday magazine. It was an article about the black middle class, and he found the article extremely offensive and was very upset to find that his picture was the one illustrating it. And I think most people don't even realize that your picture can be used without your permission and your knowledge. You know, that's something that I certainly know very well, but I think it comes as a big surprise to a lot of people, and certainly to this man, and there's nothing that you can do about that.
Celebs are fair game. Brad Pitt, naked on a beach, winds up finding his pictures in a magazine. Your mother, some years ago on a yacht. We can all understand why they're outraged. At the same time, those pictures sell for a lot of money because people seem to care.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really odd situation we have here. We wouldn't want it to happen to us, but we don't mind if it happens to somebody who's famous.
Well, people seem to start minding. We found in talking to people that, in fact, the press took quite a beating in some of our interviews, that people are starting to mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was this couple in an Iowa motel room who discovered there was a two-way mirror.
It's not just the press. It can be complete strangers. And that was actually one of the most unnerving aspects of our research. You're talking about the voyeur section. And we weren't even going to include the kind of peeping Tom stories until we started our research and kept finding case after case. And we decided this is going on enough that we have to report it. And in that case, a couple in Iowa rented a hotel room, their local Iowa City hotel, to celebrate their engagement night. And they did, as you said, found an 8-inch by 8-inch peephole behind a two-way mirror. And during their lawsuit, they found, as we did in our research, that is unfortunately not as rare as you'd like to think.
Mm-hmm.
There are cases in public restrooms.
For what reason? I could understand, even though I find it horrifying, when companies do that sort of thing because they're afraid that I don't know, people are smoking in the bathroom or spending a lot of time in the bathroom or in changing rooms in department stores when there's a fear that there'll be theft. But why in a motel room?
It's oldest reason in the world. It's the peeping Tom. Yeah, uh-huh. It's our oldest and first form of invasion of privacy that's still going on.
But we do have those other things, the changing rooms. Mm-hmm. The stores say, well, we have to protect ourselves. That we do have a fair amount of theft.
They, in fact, notify you, too. If you look, there are usually signs that say you may be under surveillance, which is a slightly unnerving thought.
Does that make it any better? What about those people who work on computers who discover that if they spend more than 30 seconds on a certain call or an assignment, that they're being monitored and judged and they may not get the advancement because they haven't done their job right?
That's another area where technology is really increasing the capability to invade people's privacy, and I think the law has not caught up with it, because this whole issue of workplace monitoring and lifestyle monitoring is something that that we read about again and again, and especially in industries and jobs where there is a lot of time spent on the computer and the tasks are fairly repetitive. You know, goals are set and you have to meet those goals, and you're monitored on your computer, on the telephone, in the bathroom. And I think that there's a point at which it doesn't increase productivity, but instead people complain that it really is dehumanizing and, in fact, you know, lowers morale. So it may not
even time how long you spend in the bathroom.
Right.
In fact, they're testing a badge that employees can wear where the employer can track them around the building and where they are at any given time.
Well, on the one hand, I understand why employers might want to have some kind of idea of where employees are and whether they're doing a full day's work. But
sure.
Right. That's the balance.
But this is kind of horrifying.
Keep coming back to the balance.
Yeah. Well, how do we strike a balance?
We have a case in our book where, you know, the company wanted us to hire security guards to work in a retail situation, and they wanted to make sure that the people that they're hiring are emotionally stable, and they were concerned that a lot of people who had been rejected from police work were now showing up to work as store security guards. And so they used a modified version of a psychological screening test that was given to police officers. And we spoke to a man who had to take this test, and it had 704 true-false questions on it about his religious beliefs, political beliefs, sexual practices, home life, early childhood. And he just found that that was not at all relevant to his ability to do this job. Mm-hmm. And that's really, I think, the question is, what kind of relevance do these intrusive either monitoring or questions have to your ability to do the job?
But we can't always know. Sometimes it's quite subtle. I saw a show on Frontline the other day in which they talked about how if you go into certain pages on the internet, people can figure out all sorts of things about you that you might not even realize they were figuring out. They if you play certain games, that gives people a psychological insight into you. If you buy certain kinds of products, then that gives them an insight into all sorts of other aspects of you. And on that level, it becomes a bit scary. People are going to start extrapolating that way.
Right. And as you said, a lot of people don't even know this. So one of the things we were hoping to get across to people is to just be aware this is going on, because sometimes your best protection is just to know what you can and cannot expect to keep private. And if surfing on the internet is not, or getting on a cellular phone is not, then you know that and you can protect yourself that way.
And cellular phones are not safe?
Well, as we learned from Princess Diana, you can apparently pluck some call or a part of a call out of the air. It's not what people have to realize is a cellular phone is not an old-fashioned phone. Email is not the U.S. mail. You have to think differently about privacy and connection to these.
Now, the British are a lot worse about this than we are, and that's because they don't have a Bill of Rights.
That's right. And the Bill of Rights, however, is only protects you against the government. Mm-hmm. And so for these kinds of invasions that we're talking about, we need other kinds of laws or just our own self-help.
And in some cases, was it Paula Jones, the woman who accused Bill Clinton of coming onto her too strongly? She had photographs that had been taken by an early love, I think, published in Penthouse. And she sued because she felt this was an invasion of her privacy, and she lost. She's a public figure. It does matter if you're a public figure, doesn't it?
The law makes a distinction in areas of privacy clashing with the press between public figures and private figures. On the one hand, public figures are just by definition deemed to be newsworthy, and more about them is newsworthy. They're also seen to have more access to the media to refute any erroneous reporting.
But sometimes when they sue,
they
still win.
The picture also would belong to the photographer who took it, not to the person whose picture it is. So they
actually had a right to publish it.
Well, I don't remember actually the circumstances of that whole lawsuit. I remember kind of the general idea, but that's what we found in the case in our book.
Mm-hmm. My guests are Ellen Alderman and Carolyn Kennedy. Their book, The Right to Privacy, is published by Knopf. Let's take a few calls, and I'll get back to some of my questions as well after we hear what the listeners have to say. Put on the headphones, okay? This is AMA 20 WNYC, New York Public Radio. I'm Leonard Lopate. Nick from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Thank you, Lenny. I believe the violation of privacy will be one of the major issues of the coming century, and I believe that it is a kind of assault. It can and does degrade the quality of human life. And as more and more people feel degraded by it, I think there'll be a human cry for changes. I believe the Fourth Amendment is inadequate. You just mentioned the reason why. It only protects against certain kinds of governmental invasions. It doesn't protect against anything broader than that. And given that Justice Scalia and many of the strict constructionists that the conservatives appointed to the Supreme Court posit that there is no right to privacy in the Constitution per se, don't you think it would be advantageous to have a movement to establish an amendment specifically guaranteeing a right to privacy? And if you do think that, is there such an amendment drafted anywhere? If there is, where is it? Can you read it to us? What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, even if you were going to amend the Constitution still speaks about government action. And there really is a welter of other laws and federal and state, and there's also state constitutions that can protect your privacy and other things not mentioned in the Constitution.
But the Supreme Court, the Warren Court, I think, started reading all sorts of rights to privacy into the Constitution that people like Scalia say are not there. And there were many decisions that were based on a right to privacy. Isn't that now established as part of our law, as part of the common law?
That's in the reproductive area. You're right. Because the word privacy does not appear in the Constitution, where the justices found it was in the notion of liberty under the 14th Amendment.
Mostly as applied to things like birth control.
Exactly. The earliest cases actually were regarding raising your children, where you could educate your child, and then it was contraceptive devices, and then finally abortion. And they said if the concept of liberty means anything, it means that the individual has a right to make these fundamental decisions without government interference. On the other hand, Justice Scalia and others say this is not in the Constitution. It's not up to us nine people here on the court to make up these rights. This is left to the states.
So when Connecticut had a law that forbade buying birth control devices, pills and diaphragms and condoms, then Scalia would say, well, it may have been a stupid law, but it was a constitutionally acceptable law.
Well, actually, that's what the dissent in that case said. They said, we think this is an uncommonly silly law, but it has nothing to do with the Constitution.
Let's take another call. John from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hi. Wholeheartedly agree with the privacy thing. I think what needs to happen is for people to assume that you want your privacy protected rather than not, even when it comes to public television and radio. I made a donation shortly after moving and started getting all sorts of junk mail from liberal organizations because they'd given out my name on the list. And you discover, oh, well, if you didn't want that to happen, you should have told us.
I mean, Now, I have no way of knowing whether lists are sold or not, but what would make you assume that we would have sold the lists, and if we had sold them, we would have sold them to liberal organizations?
Well, they were liberal organizations, but the fact is that...
I mean, you don't subscribe to any magazines at all?
What I said was that I did this shortly after I moved, so I knew where it came from.
Okay, well, let's talk about the selling of lists.
The selling of lists
by public broadcasters or anybody else
is definitely something that concerns a lot of people because once you give out the information for something that you want, you really don't know what it is done with it after that. And sort of the theoretical question is, you know, does my name and my address belong to me or does it belong to the list compiler? And I think that people have a sort of a gut reaction that it belongs to them. But in fact, these lists can be sold. But I think it's important.
But most of us don't really care, do we? I mean, I get all these catalogs.
Some people are thrilled to get it.
I just throw them in the garbage if they're not interested.
Right. But other people do mind. And I think a lot of, if you're willing to make a fairly substantial effort and devote a lot of your time to it, you can get your name off these lists. And I think a lot of companies are beginning to offer the option of not reselling your name. And I think that's important for the people who do care.
For some of them, actually, the selling of your name is the difference between profit and loss.
But John makes a good point, which is, and he's right, that the assumption is you don't care about this instead of the other way around. The assumption is not we want our privacy and you have to ask permission. It's completely the opposite.
And we thank you for your call, John. Another John now, this one also from Manhattan. Hi, you're on New York & Company.
Hi, I'm reading your first book now. And I have a couple of questions relating to this current book. Has there been lawsuits by people like the guy you mentioned, a bystander who was doing nothing wrong, who had his picture placed in a magazine, even though I imagine they didn't ask him for his permission, he wasn't involved in a crime or anything? And secondly, has there been a lawsuit by a crime victim who has not yet been part of the system, but I noticed that crime victims have been placed on pages of newspapers, even though they themselves should be asked because they hadn't done anything wrong. I actually would not allow a relative of mine to place charges against a crime because I knew it was sensational. I told them that they're going to just bother you and invade your life and just exacerbate the pain, and I wouldn't let her press charges. So I'm wondering if there was a lawsuit by someone who just felt, I'm a crime victim, you don't have any right to put my picture in the paper.
Well, you were right to warn them, because in the first question, whether that man who ended up on the cover of the magazine without his permission, he filed a lawsuit, he lost. And in fact, in the instance of crime victims, it's one of the very saddest and hardest areas, because if you're involved in a crime, completely involuntarily, obviously, if you're the victim of a crime, it's deemed to be newsworthy. And if it's newsworthy, then you can't tell the press, they can't report it. So that's one of the really saddest and hardest areas.
Since we're talking about public broadcasting, some years back, Mayor Koch suggested that the station run the names of men who had been arrested in prostitution cases, in the famous or infamous John Hour. That was constitutionally legal, wasn't it?
Well, it was if it's a matter of the public record, this is, you mentioned rape victims' name, these cases have gone all the way to the Supreme Court. If it's a matter of public record, even in the case of juveniles and all, then you really can't tell the press, they can't report something that's in a public court document. What you have to rely on is the press using its own judgment and restraint.
Uh-huh. And that has changed in recent years, do you think?
The judgment and restraint, yeah. Or the law?
The judgment and restraint. Ben Bradley said on the show that... That Watergate turned him around, that he probably would have reported all sorts of things about the private lives of government officials that he didn't. He thinks he should have reported all sorts of things that he didn't, because in the old days it was felt this was none of the public's business, even though this was the kind of stuff that some people might use to judge a public official. We have really changed in this. The press used to really keep a lot of things secret.
Well, some people look at it as keeping it secret. Other people look at it as exercising good taste and mm-hmm. judgment. So it just depends on your point of view.
Let's go to Francis from Manhattan. You're on New York & Company.
Yes. May I ask your guest, on this lack of privacy issue, in their research, how far back do they go? And the reason I ask this question, in my opinion, I think this lack of privacy really goes back to the time that Social Security came in and everyone had a number. And not only that, at about the same time, psychiatry also came into its own, where psychiatrists opened their offices. Before that, I think they may have been in institutions.
Wow. Private psychiatrists go back to Sigmund Freud. But psychiatrists are not allowed to reveal information that they learn from patients, are they?
Well, it's the medical confidentiality privilege, and I mean, it depends if they're involved in a lawsuit. Certain times it's a tough issue as to when their records are at issue. If it's like a child custody proceeding or something like that, sometimes warring spouses might try to get a hold of another one's psychiatric records, and that's obviously something that people consider very personal. But Francis also raises a very interesting point about the Social Security number, because you're right that when the idea for the Social Security number was introduced, it almost didn't pass because people were so aware and upset about what had happened in Nazi Germany, where the government was able to identify everyone by, and they didn't want a universal identification system to go into effect in this country. And I think since then, the Social Security number has become almost that, and we've seen lately a lot of lawsuits where people are challenging the use of their Social Security number for voter registration, on driver's licenses, and
it's
ways.
It's a college ID.
That's right, and I think that it is a way that people, you know, that we use to identify ourselves. And just only very, very recently, I don't know if it's sort of the cat's out of the bag or whatever, the barn door is open, or but this is very this is something that is that
one is, metaphor is as good as another.
That's right, extremely timely right now.
We thank you for your call. Barrett from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Just a really good program. Just as a small anecdote about privacy and technology, one of the interesting things that came across in the news recently in Britain, there were some sensitive documents having to do with the BBC as far as privatization of various aspects of their operation. They were faxing these documents to one of their executives who was staying over in a hotel, I think, in London. Unbeknownst to them, when they made the fax, they faxed him before he actually arrived at the hotel. Through some kind of error, the hotel staff had delivered it to an individual who was a journalist for The Guardian, I believe. This sort of fell into his hands, and of course, the journalist, realizing what he, you know, what had just dropped into his hands, promptly ran and made a story.
Yeah. And there's no privacy there. Since the both of you wrote this book largely by exchanging faxes, at least that's what I've heard, does this concern you?
Well, we were exchanging faxes into each other's homes, so that wasn't the same thing as sending it to an office or a hotel, but it's a good point. The fax, email, it's not the U.S. mail. It's not in a sealed envelope, and that's, again...
Especially email.
Yeah, that's what people have to realize.
We learned that with some... Well, Brian Gumbel learned just how much email can be invaded. Judy from Manhattan, you're on the air.
This is a wonderful show. I would like to know if in the course of writing the book or going on your speaking engagements, did you get a sense of how the public balances right to privacy versus law and order, right to privacy in the area of law and order, and which they would, most people, most Americans, would prefer to preserve if, you know, one has to be balanced against another?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have read instances in the last few years of people even asking for the police to come in and search apartment buildings because there is such a problem with weapons or drugs, or they feel so unsafe. And, of course, that would be very effective if the police searched all of our homes. But on the other hand, I think that people are also concerned if that was really going to happen, I think it would be found that they do care about privacy and that they would not probably be willing to have the government have that kind of power. So I think that obviously the difficult issue is when we all feel vulnerable, we want to be kept safe, and it's the government's responsibility to do that. But hopefully they can do it in a way that does respect our individual rights.
Judy, thank you for calling us. Your two books have been about constitutional issues. Are you going to continue in this vein?
Well, actually, our idea for this book grew out of going around and talking to people like you and all your listeners on our last book, so we're waiting to see what comes up now.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you for talking to our listeners today as well, and thank you for being on New York & Company. Ellen Alderman and Carolyn Kennedy, their book, The Right to Privacy, is published by Knopf. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.